We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Most Americans consider this to be the key line in our Declaration of Independence, the signing of which is what we celebrate today on the 4th of July. And we also, most Americans, consider that to be perhaps the clearest statement of our core value as Americans, what we treasure most in our society. Some have even advanced this a step farther and see these not just as our social and political values, not just as secular values, but as sacred spiritual values, and specifically biblical Judeo-Christian values. But how well do we really understand these important values? And how great a value do we really assign to them in our private lives? Let's take them one at a time and really think about them. The first value stated in the Declaration of Independence, the first value that it is prized the most and upon which all the others rely, is the idea, the then and really still revolutionary idea, of equality. That we are all created equal and should therefore be treated as equals with equal rights. Is this a spiritual value? Well, you can certainly find it in the Bible. If you think about it, it is one of the cornerstones of the whole Old Testament. Because the Old Testament of our Bible, the faith of the ancient Hebrews, affirmed a God who was a lawgiver. In other words, a God that did not rule by caprice or whim, but a God that ruled by law. Of course, among ancient peoples, this part was not unique to the writers of the Old Testament and their prophets. But what was unique is their understanding that this lawgiver God, his laws apply to everyone equally. That God is no respecter of persons. That there are no exceptions to God's law. There had been earlier legal codes attributed to gods. The famous Code of Hammurabi, for instance. But in that code, that God's law didn't apply the same to everyone. There were certain people to whom the law was a little kinder than others, who were seen as having privileges and right because of their status in society, or their privilege of birth, where maybe they didn't have to obey the law the same way the rest of us common folk did. And if they disobeyed, maybe they weren't punished quite as severely as the rest of us common folk were. People that felt like they had a divine right and privilege to be above the law. The revolutionary idea of the Old Testament is, no, that's not the case. If God gives law, that law has to be equal, or it isn't a law at all, any more than the law of gravity pulls down more on one of us than another. Oh, it may seem so first thing in the morning, but in reality, it pulls down on us all equally, and we all fall at exactly the same rate. So it is with God's laws. They are universal and equal. And this is a common thread running not just in the idea of God as law and God being the lawgiver in Exodus, but also throughout the biblical prophets, because again and again, the common thread we see running through all of the biblical prophets is them railing against people, especially kings, who think that somehow they have privilege. Somehow they're above the law. And the prophets argue one by one, this is not the case. Everyone must obey the law, and if the nation is in trouble, it is because they have fallen short of obeying the law or keeping the commandments, as it is often expressed by those prophets. Well, what about the New Testament? Is there a concept of equality expressed there? Well, there certainly is in the Gospels. According to Jesus Christ, and you know, not all of Jesus' ideas are actually incorporated into Christianity. This is one of them, unfortunately. According to Jesus Christ, his idea for his church would be one in which everyone was equal, where there was no hierarchy, where no one had greater status or was considered to have greater authority than anyone else. In a long passage in Matthew, he compares his ideas to those of the Pharisees. Now, they loved to have status, especially in church, but in society in general. They loved to sit at the head of the table. They loved to be called upon to lead the prayers. They loved to think of themselves as special and to set themselves apart as special, and especially religiously. Now, Jesus says he doesn't want his church or his followers to be like that. He says, you are not to be called rabbi or teacher, minister. For you have one teacher, and you are all brothers and sisters. And do not call anyone in the church father. Now, this is often mistranslated as do not call anyone on earth father. But if you read the passage, he's not talking about us dads. He's talking about Father Mulcahy or Pastor Randy. That's who he's talking about. That's who he's talking about. Call no one in the church father, he's saying. For you have only one father who is in heaven. And you must not be called masters or leaders, for you only have one master, one leader, the Christ. So his idea was we weren't going to have any hierarchy, where in church, at least, everybody was going to be treated the same, as equals. Now, of course, Jesus Christ and the authors of the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson, its principal author, and Benjamin Franklin and John Adams, its principal editors. And by the way, the Declaration of Independence was probably the only thing these three guys ever agreed on in their whole lives. They really didn't agree on much else. They agreed on the Declaration of Independence, which in itself might mean it's God inspired, because it would have taken it for these three guys to live eye to eye, see eye to eye. It is said that in later life, the only thing that kept Thomas Jefferson and John Adams alive was the hope that they would outlive each other. They both died hours apart. Adams won by about 2 hours. On the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence on the 4th of July, 1826. They both just stretched it out as long as they could, and hours apart as old men, they finally gave it up on the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration. The one thing they agreed upon, there's got to be a message there. But in any case, they all understood that we weren't all created the same. It is self-evident that this is not true. We were all different. We don't have the same talents, the same intelligence, the same physical strengths, the same abilities or aptitudes. All they believed, though, was that we should have equal rights, equal opportunities to express our own talents, our own strengths, our own abilities to the best of our own ability. That's what they believed, and then nothing should prevent us from that, prevent us from finding our place and being the best person we can be and expressing our highest talent, whatever it may be. Spiritually speaking, this is really the same thing Paul is telling us in 1 Corinthians, where he compares us all to the different organs and limbs of a single body. And he points out that all the organs and limbs of a body are different, but everyone's necessary, and everyone is important. He writes in this allegory that there should be no division or discord or lack of adaptation in the parts of a body, but each member, all the members alike, should have the mutual interest in and care for one another. And if one member suffers, all the parts of the body share in the suffering. If one member is honored, all the parts of the body are honored in the enjoyment of it. And now he says, and you all collectively are Christ's body, and individually you are members of it, each part severally and distinct, with each in his own place and function. But as he famously writes, just as the body is a unity yet has many parts, so are we. And the body cannot consist of one limb or organ, but many. And if the foot should say, because I am not the hand, I do not belong to the body, would it therefore not be a part of the body? Or the ear to the eye, would it not be a part of the body? Of course not. And if the whole body were an eye, where would be the sense of hearing, he asks? If the whole body an ear, where would be the sense of smell? God, Paul argues, has placed and arranged all the limbs and organs of the body, each particular one of them, just as he wished and saw fit and as they best serve the whole. And every part is necessary, and no part more important than any other. And so each of us are different. We have different functions. We have different talents. We fit into a different place in God's overall plan for good. But our place is essential as any other, whether or not we know it or embrace it. That's what they're really talking about with equality. This is also, by the way, what the authors of the Declaration are talking about with what may be the least understood part of that passage I read, the pursuit of happiness. What they mean by our God-given right to the pursuit of happiness, that's one of our God-given equal rights, is the then and still revolutionary idea that no one should be held back by caste or by social class or ancestry, but everyone should have the right to follow their own dream, to find their own place, and to go as far as their own particular talents, abilities, hard work, and determination will take them. And this, my friends, is the American dream. This is the siren call that lured all of our ancestors to this land, and it still is crying out its siren call today. Because you can do something here that you can't do anyplace else. You certainly couldn't at that time, and even in most of the world today, you can't. You can be whatever you want to be. You can do whatever you choose to do. And your success is up to you. And no one can tell you, because of where you were born, what class you were born into, as was true in British society back when the Declaration was signed, that this is for as far as you can go. This is the best job you can have. You have to know your place. America is populated by people whose ancestors didn't know their place, or did and didn't like it. And so they decided to come someplace else, to this place. A place that believed it was up to us what we become. Now, our ancestors didn't come here expecting a free ride. They just came here because they were free to go as far as they could push themselves. But that was enough. In fact, that was plenty. Our ancestors, like every group of people that came here before them or since, by and large, worked harder, far less, longer hours than anybody else. That was true of my ancestors. I'm sure that was true of most of your ancestors. That's true of the people that are still coming to this country today, and they were glad to do it, because whatever they achieved was their own. They weren't working for anyone but themselves and their own loved ones. That is what they meant by the pursuit of happiness. And that is one of our most valuable rights, maybe the most. They also mentioned the right to life. And by that, the authors of the Declaration of Independence meant something that was largely edited out of the document. The form that we have the Declaration of Independence in is not its original form. Quite a bit was deleted. And specifically, almost everything about what they meant by the right to life, because what they meant is our lives are our own. They do not belong to anyone else. In other words, no human being has the right to own any other human being. Now, there was a passage specifically denouncing the institution of slavery in the original Declaration of Independence, as Jefferson wrote it, and as Franklin and Adams edited it, and they both were big believers in this. They both insisted if that wasn't kept, we'd pay for it. But to get the Southern colonies to sign on at the time, they deleted it. And they were right. That decision cost us. It cost us a bloody civil war. We've been paying the price ever since. You know, I think our founders were brilliant, even inspired, but they weren't perfect. They weren't perfect. They made a few mistakes. This was one of them. And we've had to pay for those mistakes. Fortunately, they got a whole lot right. And what they didn't, well, we're free to set right in our own times. And that's what we've been doing as Americans ever since. In any case, is this idea also a spiritual ideal? This idea that we should have the right to our own lives? Well, biblically speaking, it certainly is. If you think about what is the Old Testament other than the story of a people who were slaves, who became a nation through a slave rebellion in Egypt? That's the story of the Old Testament. It is about a nation of slaves that found freedom and eventually found a land of their own and depended on their God and their faith to keep them from being enslaved by all the world powers that wanted to destroy their nation. First the ancient Assyrians, then the Babylonians, then the Greeks, but the Maccabees revolted, then the Romans, and they wandered for 2,000 years and they're back. And they're still fighting, but they still believe freedom is their right. In the New Testament, well, I think there are mixed messages because a lot of things that are attributed to Paul are not authentically so. In Galatians, a book that is pretty much universally attributed to the actual Paul, there's an important passage where Paul writes, "In Christ there is no distinction between Jew or Greek, slave or free, male or female. You are all one in Christ Jesus." We are all one. There's no slave or free. We're all equal in the church. And he meant this literally because there's about the shortest letter in the New Testament's book is a letter written to a person. Most of Paul's letters are written to a church, but this one's written to a person, although it was read in his church publicly, probably to encourage the person to do what Paul wanted him to do. This person's name was Philemon. And Philemon had a former slave that had apparently taken off and attached himself to Paul, and through Paul had become converted to Christianity. And Paul told his former slave, you need to go back. You need to go back to Philemon voluntarily. I'm going to give you a letter to take to him, but you need to ask him to set you free. And that whole letter is making an argument that Philemon should do just that. He should set this slave free. And Paul says, I'll be personally responsible if he owes you anything. But Christians should be free, not just in church. They should be free out in the world, Paul argues. That the idea of liberty and equality in Christ is not just a spiritual or theological ideal. It is a physical and personal ideal, too, that we must live up to. Now, there are places in Paul that seem to go against this, but they're almost all added. For instance, there's a famous passage. It's quoted way more often than it ought to be. There are two verses in 1 Corinthians where Paul seems to suggest women should know their place. It's in the 14th chapter of 1 Corinthians, verses 34 and 35. And anyone can pretty much see that this was added by somebody, because if you read that chapter 14 and you leave those two verses out, it makes sense. If you put them in, it makes less sense. Those two verses about how women should stand their place and should go to their husbands if they want to know what's what, it doesn't fit in with anything else in that whole chapter, or for that matter, with anything else in the whole book. I mean, I can just see this second century copyist whose nagging wife, who was this henpecked copyist, whose wife had just given him a really bad time, just copying this down, thinking, ah, fix her. No, this is not Paul. The other things not Paul are two letters. They're almost anti-Paul. They're sometimes referred to, or three letters actually, they're referred to as the pastoral epistles, 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus. And in those, Paul seems to be arguing, from the language we can tell they were written about close to the second century, certainly someone beyond Paul's time, well beyond. They seem to argue that if you're a slave, God must want you to be one, so just be the best slave you can be. And if you're a master, then just be the nicest master you know how to be, because God selected you. But just stay put, know your place, in other words. These three books were very popular in the Old South before the Civil War. And they were probably written to be popular in the old Rome, which was a society even more dependent on slavery than America's old South. And either members of the Christian community had prospered to the point where they had slaves of their own, or maybe they were just trying to get Rome off their back, because the abolitionists would be no more popular in Rome than they were in the pre-Civil War South. In fact, it could even bring on persecutions. It could be thought of as sedition, thought of as preaching the slaves should be set free, should maybe free themselves, rebel. This would not have been a popular idea with the Romans. This would not be anything you'd want to get out. Romans wanted obedient slaves. They had that Spartacus rebellion, and that was all they ever wanted to hear from the slaves ever again. And any faith that preached slaves should be free, they didn't want any part of. But freedom is taught throughout the Bible. It's taught by Paul, the authentic Paul, by Jesus Christ. It's certainly the ideal of the Old Testament. And it was most certainly the ideal of Thomas Jefferson and John Adams and Benjamin Franklin. I think what the 4th of July really should be about are these our ideals? I think instead of fireworks, what we should do on the 4th of July is ask ourselves if we are still aspiring to these ideals in our own lives. The ideals that make us Americans. Are we, for instance, aspiring to treat everyone equally, to think of everyone equally? Even people don't look like us, even people who have a different accent, be it foreign and domestic, whether they sound like they're from the country or from down south or from the inner city or from New Jersey, that we treat everyone equally no matter what high school they went to. You know, we're a living demonstration of that here in St. Louis. Any of you that grew up in the 50s and 60s know, Reverend Sharon and I went to Normandy, she went to Ritner. It shouldn't work. But there's harmony here. They believed, no, the founders did, whatever religious background you had, you should be treated equally, thought of equally, no matter what denomination you went to, whether or not you were a churchgoer. And by the way, I have a theory that all those Americans that always in those surveys say, oh, 90% of Americans are churchgoers. I think if they asked that question more carefully, they'd find out by churchgoers, they meant they went on Easter, Christmas, and Mother's Day. My personal opinion, I don't know if that makes you a churchgoer. But you are regular. I know the parking lot is fuller on those 3 days of the year. Even if somebody is not a Jew or a Christian, I think our founders, you know, they used language that talk about a creator with a capital C, but they're careful to avoid any language that expresses a connection to any particular religion or denomination. They did that on purpose. So even if you're a non-Christian, that's okay. I mean, yeah, there's a famous person a lot of people think might actually be a Muslim, and I'm pretty sure it's true. I'm convinced Dr. Oz is a Muslim. But I think he's still okay. You know, so is that Casey Kasem guy that did America's Top 40. But I haven't given up on classic rock and roll anyway. Whatever we are, do I treat everyone as equal? What's more, do I think of myself as being the equal to any other person in any situation? Do I aspire to that, or have I been believing that I'm not equal, not as good as somebody, not capable, or the equal to a problem? Do I believe that I have the right to live other people's lives? Or do I believe my loved ones' lives are their own, that they should live them with my encouragement but not my interference? And do I believe I have the right to live my own life, to pursue my own bliss, to find my own happiness, to be my own person? Do I believe that I was born free, that freedom's my destiny, and that no one and nothing can hold me back other than my own ambition or lack of determination? Do I believe I can go as far as my own talents and my own hard work and my own dreams can take me? I think what the 4th of July should be about is not asking ourselves whether these are American values or spiritual values, but asking ourselves, am I making these my values? And maybe we should do it more than just once a year. Let's pray about ourselves, and to center ourselves for our time of prayer, let's know and affirm the truth that we are in the presence of the Creator of all things and all people, that we are now in the presence of God's pure being, that there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in our lives. God the good, omnipotent. Together, there's only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God the good, omnipotent, and so it is.